This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, a good time right now to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Along with our caller, Zorba, always some interesting information to pass along to listeners.
Yes, we're going to talk about the new asthma inhalers. Asthma inhalers set to go green. Is it a good idea or a bad idea? And where did the FDA sit on this one?
Asthma inhalers going green.
Yeah, we'll
okay,
talk about
coming
it.
Up, Anne.
And we're also going to talk about supplementation with vitamin E or selenium. Does it or does it not reduce the risk of prostate cancer? Late-breaking research that we will talk about today.
Stay tuned. Tune for that one and our recipe.
Yes, Vicky. Vicky is giving us a banana bread recipe. Banana bread recipes tend to be high fat. You know, they're not actually the healthiest recipes in the world. Mm-hmm. She's got a recipe that is dynamite. I call it banana bread comfort food.
That's from Streamwood, Illinois listener Vicky Frederick, coming up in about 25 minutes or so. 800-462-7413. It's toll free. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Montgomery, Alabama. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have a curiosity question. I am the child of a mother who was taking birth control, so I fell into that 1% of kids who was born while her mother used birth control. But the curiosity part comes in that I have been pregnant now 5 times while using birth control. So my question is there any kind of genetic predisposition to conceiving while on birth control that
wow.
you are a product of?
Isn't that interesting? Can I ask a personal question? What kind of birth control?
Tricycline.
Uh-huh.
I don't take it anymore because I know I get pregnant on it. And I would take it every day at the same time, and the doctor would always look at me like, yeah, you must have missed a day. And I'd say, no, really, I haven't missed one day.
So in other words, you would take the orthotricycline every single day, you didn't miss a day, and you have 5 children.
No, I actually only carried 1 to term.
You only carried 1 to term.
But 5 okay. pregnancies.
Well, that's a lot of pregnancies, yeah.
The others were miscarriages.
Uh-huh. That is a lot of pregnancies. Well, when we look at birth control pills, there's a failure rate. And the failure rate is roughly 1 in 1,000. I mean, that's roughly what...
Not for her.
No, obviously the failure rate for you is not 1 in 1,000. It's not 1 in 1,000. And what the birth control pill does, you know, what the pill does is it basically fakes the body into thinking that you've ovulated when you've not ovulated. And so so essentially an egg is not produced. And obviously in your case, it doesn't fake your body. And the treatment, first of all, it may be that no hormonal foreign birth control is going to work for you, but it may be that you would need a higher dose birth control pill to make it work. The problem is the higher the dose, the more likely you are to have side effects, including deep vein thrombosis, thromboembolism, where you get blood clots and the other issues. But you bring up an interesting point. I don't know if there's a genetic
predisposition. That's just what I was going to ask, if there was a genetic predisposition. It sounds like it for her.
Well, it sounds like it. So your mom, how many kids did your mom have?
3.
She had 3. And you were...
And two of her pregnancies were... Pill babies.
Pill babies.
Pill babies.
I'm a pill baby. I love it. A baby with the pill. Well, you know, you bring it. It's a good issue. And I think the answer is there always are individual differences. When we do studies, we know there's a failure rate. And obviously in your family, there's a failure rate. You've got a question. You've got a child. Is it a boy or a girl?
A boy.
A boy. Okay. Well, then you don't have to tell him to be careful not to get pregnant.
So I'm hoping I don't have to have that conversation for some time.
Well, good luck to you. And the answer is, you know, obviously the pill is not right for you. You'll have to use a barrier method or, you know, it's not as if you want to go through a test case and try a higher dose of pill to
yeah,
see
I'm,
if that would
I'm
work.
Not interested in turning myself into a science project that we've actually been using the... family natural family planning method
where
you figure out when you ovulate and you just don't, you know. So I've been doing that for a couple of years and that seems to work.
So here we are. It's a good example. Well, natural family planning or rhythm is superior to the pill. Way to go.
Thank you. Whatever works.
So, well, thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Excuse me. I appreciate your answer. Yep. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
You know, it's interesting with the last caller. She said, yes, ma'am, and then she said, yes, sir. And, you know, my voice is a bit high. And so it's kind of interesting because a lot of times I'll be on the telephone and I'll call up for something. You know, maybe I want to order something. And I'll be on the phone and they'll say, yes, ma'am. And most of the time, I do not correct them. It's just not worth it because, and also, they're usually embarrassed. The problem is when they say, give me your name, and I say, Zorba, Z-O-R-B-A, and they'll go, oh, Zorba, is that your husband's name? And usually at that particular time, I've lost it so much that I have now become embarrassed over the charade that has occurred, and I don't know what to do, and I've never been, and then I blush, and that's it. That's it. The interaction is over. So, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, as long as they serve it correctly. So, thanks.
800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
I have a problem. The problem isn't that I got married, but the problem came after that.
I hope not.
I got a titanium wedding ring because I'm allergic to kind of everything. Hmm. And I heard that was the medically neutral ring to get. And I wore it every day for about 2 weeks straight. And then I started getting a rash on my finger. And so I took it off, and I've been not wearing it that often. You know, kind of just whenever I go out in public, I put it on. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to wear it more often, and I was wondering if you had any ideas.
Yeah, have you tried gold rings in the past, and they haven't worked for you?
I haven't tried gold rings in the past. I haven't really done much of any jewelry. I mean, I have a watch that has, I guess it's a stainless steel on the top, but then leather band, but I don't wear that too often. It's just, I'm allergic, you know, I'm allergic to milk. I'm allergic to...
Yeah, but I never heard. Where'd you hear this thing about titanium is less allergic than gold is?
I heard that titanium is what you use to put in for like surgical operations. They put in titanium implants, and somebody said, I had just been reading up on it, and I read that if you tend to be an allergic person, titanium is the way to go.
Uh-huh. Well, I think titanium is one of the least allergic metals that there are. What's your wife say?
She says, I hope Zorba has an answer.
I can save the marriage, in for the rescue. That's it. Save the marriage. He's got a rash on his finger. And I take it, I mean, you do go out in public all the time, unless you stay in your house all the time. You know, yeah. You're going to want to wear your ring. Well, first of all, it may be that anything. Let's go to your watch. Any trouble with your watch at all?
No, I don't have trouble with my watch. But some other things that do happen is I teach and I write on a chalkboard, and I'm allergic to chalk.
Oh,
and so I tend to wear I'll cut up a thick linen napkin and I'll wrap that around the chalk. I've used those chalk holders. Uh-huh. And they just don't work for
me. Yeah, well, you can't wear linen on your finger when you're putting the ring on.
No,
I don't that would not work in the least. So getting back to the issue, first of all, one of the things that may happen is it may be that it's just the fact that the ring itself is not allowing the finger enough area, not exactly to breathe. I mean, fingers don't breathe, but enough area. It may be too tight on the finger. Is it a very loose ring or is it a tight ring?
No, I can spin it.
Okay, you can. Well, spin it means it's a loose ring.
Yeah.
A couple of easy examples. What I would do is, first of all, for a while, I would try over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. Cheap, inexpensive. It only comes in a 0.5% cream, and I would put that on your finger every night before you go to sleep so it has a chance to kind of soak into the skin.
Uh-huh.
And then I would put the ring on and see if that works. And if it works, you may periodically have to use hydrocortisone. That's one answer. The other answer is to see whether or not gold will not react. I mean, titanium, yes, is a non-reactive metal, but you might react to that and you might not react to gold.
Okay.
And gold, you know, once again, you may want to get an inexpensive 14-karat gold ring and just see if you can wear it before you go and you buy a more expensive ring that you may be for your marriage. And if gold doesn't work, then you would try platinum.
All right.
But the marriage is going okay?
It's going great.
Good. I'm glad to ride to the rescue.
Right on.
Thanks. Thanks
right,
a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. Yeah, I don't wear mine at night. I take mine off when I go to sleep.
Uh-huh. Well,
and you don't wear yours at all.
No, I can't stand rings. I don't wear them at all. And when I go to meetings and stuff, I'm not wearing a ring. People often will look at
women
say,
hit on you, do they?
Yeah, women hit on me all the time. That's right.
That's terrible.
That's right.
And then you have to
right.
Hey, I'm married.
That's right. All the time. And I go to meetings in such great places like Rockford, Illinois. I get hit on all the time. The Quad Cities in Illinois. Oklahoma City, I got it. No matter where I go to the big places. But let me tell you, New York, Chicago, nobody hits on me. The high fashion women, they don't even look.
800-462-7413. So what's this, Zorba, about changing asthma inhalers? What, for the environment?
Well, let's talk about the environment. I mean, I'm pro-environmental. I've been recycling for hundreds
of
years.
You're on public radio.
Public radio. Yeah. I would never, ever think of doing something that was environmentally bad.
Of course not.
Not in the least. But what happens is we have CFCs. CFCs are chlorofluorocarbons, and the feds decided to get rid of CFCs. Very important. Now, CFCs were present in lots of things, especially spray paint. Spray paint. Lots of CFCs. There's lots of spray paint. So the feds decided we want to get rid of them in the entire environment because they're bad for the ozone. Not just those big cans of spray paints, but the little itsy-bitsy cans for asthma inhalers. Okay, little itsy-bitsy cans for asthma inhalers.
Now, were they really bad for the environment?
Well, they're chlorofluorocarbons. They're CFCs, so they are bad for the environment. But you have to look at how much of the environmental load came from asthma inhalers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if you have lots of people going out and spraying their asthma inhaler all over. It was probably an extremely small, tiny load in the environment for asthma inhalers. I mean, picture one can of spray paint.
Yeah.
How many asthma inhalers can you get into a can of spray paint? That kind of...
Right. And the spray paint is going in right into the environment.
Yeah,
the inhaler is going into your mouth.
I think it was a cogent
argument.
You make a rule and it applies to everything. It applies to everything.
Yeah.
So what happens is this, though. The drug companies then had to develop a different methodology of delivering the asthma medicine. So they used a dry powder methodology. This dry powdered methodology was different. It's called an HFA methodology. Dry powder, it feels different in the back of the throat. People have to use the inhaler differently. They could sense when the propellant was going in with the other inhaler because they could feel it.
Sure.
With the HFA, they can't. The powder tends to get stuck in the inhaler, so you have to wash the inhaler once a week. And for some of the inhalers, you have to use a little pin in the inhaler to make sure you get the powder out. You can just see where this is going.
Yeah.
And then the coup, you know, the piece de resistance is that the asthma inhalers had finally come down in price to $5 to $10 an inhaler, and the new ones cost $30 to $60.
Whoa.
So $30 to $60 for an inferior product that takes more stuff because of this little itsy-bitsy amount of CFC that was going into the environment. And the final thing is the fact that now people with severe asthma have been educated onto the different inhalers by their pulmonologists or their doctors. But the people who rarely use inhalers, they don't even know this is coming.
Right.
So all of a sudden, I've had three patients in the last week call me up. I had one guy who called me up and he said, I can't stand this new inhaler. It doesn't work. I've been going around to all the pharmacies. I don't care if I have to pay. Give me an unlimited prescription. And he's now stockpiled 50 inhalers. I said, you don't use 50 inhalers over the next 2 years. He said, I don't care. I thought, all right. He's now going to start to use an inhaler that is outdated because he likes the fact that he likes the fluorocarbon. He doesn't have to deal with it for
50 of the inhalers that are going off the market.
He is on the road. He's a traveling salesman. Wherever he goes, he takes a prescription and goes to a pharmacy and uses the inhalers.
He's ruining the environment.
My guess is 50 little inhalers probably fit into one can of spray paint for the amount of gas. Nonetheless, it's our federal government helping us live.
C'est la vie. 800-462-7413. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma now. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I have a question about French press coffee. I subscribe to a health newsletter, and also I get an online newsletter. It's called Real Age. I can't remember which one I heard this on, but because it's not filtered through paper, there's fat in it. It doesn't filter out the fat. I didn't even know there was fat in coffee. I just drink one cup a day, and I use half-calf, half-regular coffee, so I can't use the coffee bags for a single cup. And I just wanted to know if you had heard anything about fat in coffee.
Zorba knows the answer to this, but help me out. What is French press coffee?
It's you put the coffee in hot water in this cylindrical tube, and then you let it steep for about 5 minutes, and then you have the top of it has a plunger with a grate in it with a wire mesh, and when you push down, it pushes the coffee to the bottom and lets the water with the coffee mixture come to the top, so you don't have any grounds.
What's the point of this? Why do you? I'm sorry. Well, I didn't know that was
for
funny.
Somebody who drinks Nescafe and doesn't care about the taste of coffee, can't figure this out.
I drink Nescafe, but I drink gourmet Nescafe.
Yeah, right.
The gourmet Nescafe.
Well, actually, the problem is twofold. One, it's very convenient, and the other, my wife used to be the assistant manager at Williams-Sonoma. We've got more kitchen toys than you'll ever.
I get it.
I want to go to his garage sale. That's what I want to go. Well, for those with no taste of instant coffee, there's no reason to even carry on this conversation. But French press coffee is wonderful. I was first introduced to it 2 decades ago, and I've got like 3 or 4 little French presses, and they're great. I use the single cup one in my office. That's exactly it, because I've got some ground coffee there, which is really good ground coffee. I put in the hot water, and I know what you're talking about. First of all, there is some oil in coffee. These are aromatic hydrocarbons, they're called, and they are oily. There's little oil, and if you look at it afterwards, you can sometimes actually see it on the surface, and I noticed it on the surface of my French press coffee. And, you know, now that I think about it, I don't notice it in the coffee where I actually have have a filter. If you begin to worry about the fat in your coffee, you could have a heart attack from that fear.
Okay.
So my recommendation is exactly what Tom would say. Go to Nescafe, and you don't have to worry about it at all.
Well, I appreciate it. No, I'm not a hypochondriac. I just don't want to add anything in that.
You are adding a pinch.
Okay. I'm not going to sweat it.
That's right. That's exactly it. Don't sweat it. But there have been a lot of studies that have looked at coffee and heart disease. Let's go to the other bottom line. Does coffee cause heart disease? And the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's no evidence that coffee causes heart disease. There's actually good evidence that people who drink coffee are less likely to get diabetes. And so there are lots of good things for coffee. The French press is the way to go. Boiling your coffee like they do in Norway appears to be associated with a higher incidence of esophageal cancer. So as long as you French press it and you don't boil it, you're home free. And as long as your wife still works at Williams-Sonoma, or did
no, she
stop?
Doesn't.
Well, congratulations. Then you'll get some free room in your cabinets. Thanks for your call.
Great. Thank you. Bye.
Sure. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Zorba, time now for another edition of Stump the Doc, which our friends in Spokane, Washington have pointed out creates an unfortunate acronym. Today's question comes from Judy in Madison, Wisconsin. She explains that when she went to get her flu shot, she was asked about her prior reactions to the shot. Judy explained that after the previous shots, her lips had swelled. She was then informed that she could not receive the shot. Why?
Probably from egg allergy. That's usually what it is. The flu vaccine is done with eggs. So the answer is yes, she cannot receive the shot. She can get flu mist, which is a live virus. It's not made with eggs, and she could do that instead. But what I'm more interested in, how she looks at acronyms, Stump the Doc. I'm stumped with that. And it's STD, and she's talking about STD as
no, 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 she isn't. We've called it, we said Stump the Doc a number of times, and people in Seattle have let our producer know.
So it's the Seattle people that look at acronyms and immediately thought of an illegal drug called STD. I love it. I love it. Well, that's where the brains in Seattle are. So getting back to the issue
of him. No, it's not an illegal drug.
Sure it is. STD. STD was an illegal drug in the 70s and the early 80s.
Sexually transmitted disease.
I'm stuck on the drug culture. And you're thinking about sex. We know what you're thinking about all of the time. So getting back to the real question, yes. which is flu, she can't have the vaccine because she's probably allergic. She can have the flu mist instead.
Think you can stump public radio's favorite family doc? Then send us your question to
Zorba at WPR.org. I'm going to get rid of acronyms. I'm going to free my life of acronyms forever.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Hey, we have our recipe coming up. And after that, more of your calls. And, of course, we have our medical myth buster coming up. Lots more interesting research to talk over. So many great reasons to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have listeners waiting on the phone, but we have an open line for you. If you have a question for Zorba, let me give you our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. But of course, before our next call, it is recipe time, and I am happy to welcome with us on the phone Streamwood, Illinois listener Vicki Frederick. Vicki, hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for sending in Vicky's banana bread. Now, banana bread we usually think about is not such a healthy food, but this is healthy, right?
It's pretty healthy. It's got a little fiber in it. It does not have much fat in it, which is good. And the fat that I put in is a small amount of healthier fat instead of the saturated fat. So mm-hmm. I think it's pretty healthy.
How'd you come up with this one?
Actually, I'm always trying to remake recipes and make them a little bit healthier, adding fiber and taking away fat, and usually that's not too hard to do. In this case, I actually didn't have all the ingredients I needed for the original recipe, so I started substituting healthier things that I did have, and I think this one turned out pretty well.
Uh-huh. Do you notice a taste difference?
You know, I really don't. The one thing that is different when you don't use a lot of fat is baked products tend not to last as long. In other words, if you ate it in a couple days, you wouldn't notice much difference. If you ate it on the third day, it might be a little dried out. But with banana bread, that's not usually a problem because there are plenty of people who will gobble it up for you.
There you go. The first thing I noticed, and I love this recipe, is how little oil it uses. I mean, the traditional banana bread recipe uses a ton of oil. I can remember looking at one of the recipes when I really first started doing some baking and realized that it was really banana cake. I mean, we may call it banana bread, or we could call it oily bananas with some carbohydrate. It was I mean, it really, you know, because it uses so much oil and there's so little oil. When we did the analysis, the typical serving was about 185, 200 calories, and there were only 25 to 30 calories coming from fat. It's a low fat comfort food, and yes. I really like that. I'm a foodie. I love all different kinds of food. I really like it, but I also like traditional comfort food recipes that remind me of mom. Now, my mom was an awful cook. God bless her. May she rest in peace. She knew how to eat, but she did not know how to cook and bake. I had aunts who really liked to cook and did a good job. But one of the things she would make was banana bread. So I can remember sitting around the house when she would mash up the bananas. But her banana bread, well, that was back years ago when it was a high-fat recipe and nobody knew about fat.
Let's put this one together.
Okay, start out with 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour.
Cup and a half all-purpose flour.
And what I like about this, 1/2 cup of whole wheat flour.
1/2 cup of whole wheat flour.
So you added that to your recipe?
Yes, I substituted 1/2 cup of whole wheat for some of the white flour.
I think it's a great idea. You know, whenever we can add fiber to the diet, we want to add fiber to the diet. I mean, that's the answer. 3/4 cup of sugar.
3/4 cup of sugar.
1 teaspoon of baking soda.
Little tea, baking soda.
1/2 teaspoon of baking powder.
half a little tea baking powder.
Teaspoon of salt.
A little tea salt.
Couple of eggs. Two eggs.
2 eggs.
3 large bananas, ripe and mashed. So how ripe are your bananas?
Oh, we want them past the speckle stage, getting into the darkening stage. The riper, the better.
The riper, the better, because
now,
it gets sweet.
Why is that?
You know, they're very sweet when they get ripe like that, and they add a lot of flavor to the banana bread. If they're not sweet enough, then, you know, then you'd have to add sugar to make it taste as sweet as it does.
Gotcha.
So I think that's where my mom got. My mom was also very thrifty cook, and I think basically it was the bananas that had gone past their prime, which is probably why she would.
She wanted to use them.
Yeah, she wanted to use them, exactly, so that's really good. Three tablespoonfuls of skim milk.
3 big tea skim milk.
Yeah, and if you don't have skim milk around the house, you know, I'm sure you could use regular, 2% milk, which is what we have in our house. 1/2 cup of yogurt, plain and non-fat.
1/2 cup of plain non-fat yogurt.
Now, that makes a lot of sense to me because you want to have yogurt that you're using here that doesn't add sweetness to it because you're controlling that with the banana, right? So it's a plain yogurt.
Right. Now, I did notice I've made it with vanilla yogurt just because I was out of the other.
Mm-hmm.
It only adds, maybe 5 calories, and it doesn't seem to change the sugary taste that much. So if you're in a pinch and you don't have the plain, you could use vanilla. It would be okay.
And it would be okay with that. Okay.
Yes.
Sometime. And then 1 tablespoonful of canola oil.
Mm-hmm. Big tea
Big
canola.
Tea. Okay, so let's make it. Preheat the oven at 325 degrees. If you do not have an oven thermometer, go out and buy one. They're great. Most ovens are off by 15 to 50 degrees. And if you don't have an oven thermometer, you're never going to be sure how you're baking things. And a lot of people who don't bake or who bake and say everything burns, well, it burns because your oven is too hot.
Right. You know, mine is too low. And I have a thermometer. I have to turn my oven up over what the
what it is on the dial. And the fact is those thermometers are cheap. I mean, you're talking about $3 to $5, and they last forever, so an oven thermometer. And on our website, we'll put a little connection with the oven thermometers that I would recommend. We'll put that on zorbapastor.org for people who want that. So combine the dry ingredients in a separate bowl, then beat the eggs slightly, then in the eggs, beat in the bananas until they're mixed well. Add the milk, yogurt, and oil. Mix that well. And then add this banana mixture to the dry ingredients and mix until all are combined and then pour into the bun pan. Do you spray the bun pan?
Yes, with non-stick cooking spray. And I spray it until that whole surface on the inside is covered.
Very important, because otherwise it's not going to come out. I've got a Teflon bun pan, but, you know, eventually the Teflon kind of wears out.
Mm-hmm.
That's been sprayed well with the cooking spray. Then bake at 325 for about an hour or until a toothpick inserted in the center comes out clean. Put it on a plate. Maybe serve it with some French press gourmet coffee. I think that would be perfect. Get rid of the Nescafe. Toss the Nescafe and go to French press dark roast coffee. And I'm ready. Lovely recipe. I am sure that lots of our listeners will sign up for it.
Thanks a lot, Vicki.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate your sending this to us. And for doing that, you get a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low fat recipe to us at
zorba@wpr.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
zorbapastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on your health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org.
Our toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. That's the number you call if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. A listener has been waiting, Zorba, in St. Charles, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help you?
Well, I have an odd question, and I've been waiting to see if someone else would ask this one, but no one has.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a 5-year-old daughter that has an amazingly large bladder capacity, and it didn't really strike me as being something we should be concerned about until a friend of mine said, you know, people who have to urinate frequently, sometimes that's a sign of diabetes, and it started me thinking that maybe a child who can hold it for in excess of 16 hours Is there something wrong? Does she have an abnormally large bladder? When she does go, she certainly goes, and she's not intentionally holding it. But in the morning on the weekends, for example, sometimes it'll be noon, 1, 2 o'clock from when she had woken up in the morning before she'd actually used the bathroom.
Wow. I was going to ask, how amazingly large is this capacity? 16 hours seems like a long time, doesn't it?
It is. And, you know, when we get for car trips, we'll go for 8 hours, and she refuses to get out to go to the bathroom because she's busy watching her DVD or whatever she's doing, and she doesn't really want to be bothered to have to go to the bathroom.
Wow.
But we've never, ever had a problem with accidents at night. Not once has she ever even had a little bit of wetness at all, no accidents. And we've never had a UTI problem.
It's interesting. Zorba will say whether there's any physical problem here, but I know right now parents throughout the public radio listening audience are saying, let me have this kind of problem with my kid. not having to stop every, 2 hours or so when we're on a trip to get to the bathroom. Zorba, is there a concern here?
Not at all. No concern in the least. First of all, let's talk about the diabetes. Juvenile diabetes, you would know she would be losing weight, she would be tired, she would be weak. A situation such as that, and they have this for rate, they want to drink all the time. So that's not the issue. Now, getting back to what your daughter does, I think if you look at how much she drinks, she probably does not drink a lot. Now, in America, we've become drinking nuts. Now, I don't mean drinking alcohol nuts, but water nuts. You know, no, there's no document evidence that we need eight-ounce glasses of water a day. And you look at people, we have people who call up the show all the time, and they'll say, well, I drink 12 to 16 Cokes a day, and yeah, I don't consider it to be that much.
Well, my mother told me eight glasses of water a day.
That's right.
So
well, your mother
was always
what else?
Right.
What, yes, exactly. Your mother and my mother, they never made a mistake. You know, just like my mother said, don't sit too close to the TV. Your hair will fall out and you'll lose your mind. She was right about the hair, but not about the mind. Getting back, though, to this, there really is nothing wrong. And she probably doesn't drink very much at all. And she may have a slightly bigger capacity, but boy, does she have strong detrusor muscles. Those are the muscles that keep the urine in. The best advice for most people is drink when you're thirsty, not when you're not thirsty. That turns out to be the best advice. Now, I know that goes against the teaching of the bottled watered industry that wants us to flush our kidneys. I have no idea how to flush a kidney. It's not the same as flushing a toilet. But your daughter is fine. Enjoy this time. You don't have, as Tom said, you're lucky you don't have to stop 10 times on the car trip to see Grandma.
Well, good to know there's nothing wrong. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd say I appreciate the call, but after talking about this for a couple of minutes, I have to cross my legs for the rest of the program.
Yes, but yours is a prostate problem.
Anyway, let me rush through this. You'll remember, Zorba, that not too long ago, we were chatting about hemp seed in peanut butter and wondering if it would register on a drug test. Remember
yes,
that?
Yes.
Well, of course, our inbox was immediately flooded with emails, including this one from Katie Kearney, owner of Naturally Nutty Foods, the store our listener purchased the peanut butter from.
Oh, cool.
Who wrote to set us straight. She writes, hemp seed is perfectly legal, approved by the USDA, and is a highly nutritious food grown in Canada. Unlike marijuana, hemp contains only minute, less than 1% amounts of THC, the primary psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. Katie continues, there are no psychoactive effects involved with eating hemp products. But if testing is a concern, then obviously our customers need to make their own judgments, and we encourage them to do so. We feel confident that the amounts of hemp seed in our products won't create any problems with drug testing.
Well, that's it. And they do test for THC. That's what they're testing for. So obviously, it sounds like it's something that's minimal. But it may fit into the same thing as the poppy seed issue with poppy seed buns, which I don't know, by the way, how much of an urban myth that is.
Yeah, right.
We
right,
look at the poppy
right,
seed issue.
Yeah.
So the answer sounds like you can use hemp seeds, eat hemp seeds or hemp seed butter with impunity. I'm glad that she set me straight. on that point.
Thanks for clearing this up, Katie. If you need to contact the show, you can do so by sending an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Some really interesting research coming up. We have our medical myth buster and more of your calls, too, here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But right now, Zorba, before our next call, time for research and an interesting one. Many, I think, take vitamin E or selenium, hoping to reduce their risk of prostate cancer. We now have some research on that issue.
Right. Doesn't work. Doesn't work. Very, very interesting. Well, first of all, let's look at what we do know. We do know, and there are always complicated things, that people who eat foods that are rich, men, guys, mm-hmm. who eat rich foods that have a lot of vitamin E and selenium seem to work. And so now we then go and look at supplementations. And we've got a couple of studies. And when we look at statistical associations with food or what we're doing, there are only three explanations for these associations. Either it's bias, or it's chance, or there's cause. Mm-hmm. So we want to know, do the foods that you eat really cause this? And then sometimes we'll ferret things out, in this case, vitamin E and selenium, yeah. and see what it is. These are two large studies that looked at vitamin E supplementation and selenium, and it shows that when you take vitamin E or selenium or vitamin E and selenium, it does not at all increase or reduce the risk of your developing prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So if you're taking vitamin E and selenium to prevent prostate cancer, it's worthless. And this is an important issue. We've seen a drop in prostate cancer in recent years, but there still are nearly 30,000 deaths of prostate cancer, making it basically the second leading cause of cancer death in America for 2008 after lung cancer. That's a lot.
A couple of interesting things, I think. First of all, we don't see a lot of research on supplements and vitamins. Is this a growing kind of
trend? Well, what happens is the supplement vitamin research to prevent cancer means you've got to get a lot of people and watch them for a lot of years.
Right.
So you've got to get 50 to 75,000 people who take the vitamins or the placebo, and you've got to follow them for 4 or 5 years. That's tough research. That's not easy research to do. It's not the same as doing 1,000 people and giving them a drug and seeing if it lowers their cholesterol or not. So these are tough, tough studies. And so we don't see a lot of them. But when we see them, we then have to get rid of the urban myth. In other words, for years, I thought vitamin E prevented dementia. It doesn't. We now know that. And for years, I thought vitamin E and selenium may prevent prostate cancer. Well, when the science is there and it says it doesn't do it, it doesn't do it.
Is there any reason for me now to take vitamin E or selenium?
Not at all. I think a multivitamin which has a little E and a little selenium is fine. I think taking extra vitamins is not useful. Now, I think taking and eating foods that are high in vitamin E, nuts, can be very good for your heart, very good for your brain, very good because they contain omega-3 fatty acids. And taking foods that have selenium or a touch of selenium and a multivitamin is fine. But extra supplementation doesn't work to prevent prostate cancer.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
I've got a question for you about recent statements that have been made with respect to cell phone use and cancer, and I wanted to get your opinion.
Ah, yeah, that's been going on for a while, the idea that if you use a cell phone too much right up against your head, that there's the danger, at least the possible danger of cancer. That's what you're talking about, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's quite interesting. When I think of this, this reminds me of back in the old days of the 50s and the 60s, when my mother said, if I sit too close to the television set, I'll get cancer, my eyes will go cross, I'll lose my hair, and everything else will go bad. I'll become demented. No, that part wasn't there. But there was so much stuff with technology and getting close to technology. I remember my mother would actually measure how far away from the television set I had to be.
She might have been right on that hair loss thing.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much. Thank you. That's exactly right. But the cell phone cancer issue is not a small issue. It's a big issue. And it's a big issue because if indeed we are causing cancer by listening to cell phones, well, when cell phones started a decade and a half ago, really big the last 5 years, we would have some major issues. So European Union, FDA have both looked at this, as well as the National Institute of Health, to see whether or not there's any theoretical increase or any increase that they can measure. And to date, there is no credible evidence that cell phone use at all is associated with cancer. Now, given that, we had to look at what cell phone use is associated with. And the reality is we now know that when you use your cell phone in the car, the lack of attentiveness on the cell phone, even if it's hands-free, is about the same as having 1 to 2 drinks of alcohol.
Yeah.
That's the real issue. Even if it's hands-free, because we must be attending to the sound and listening to somebody. We're thinking differently. It's clearly obvious that it's different than having somebody in the automobile. But cancer, I don't think it's an issue.
Thanks, Zorba. I'll hang up for my cell phone now.
Okay, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. And he should not worry about the cell phone.
Not at all. Not at all.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time once again for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with the tongue. We've discussed the basic tastes on this show before, sweet, sour, bitter, salty, but is it true that the tongue divides these tastes to different areas?
No, the answer is yes. It definitely is true. Now, how specific these areas are something else, but that is not a myth. When we look at the tongue, and we did basic science research years ago, we found, for instance, the tip of the tongue is very, very sensitive to sweet. Very, very sensitive to sweet. So think about it. Ice cream is cold. It's sweet. Yeah. You love touching it on the tip of your tongue. Yeah. I mean, you're sort of imagining
I've never tried it, but are you saying if I had a little salt in my hand and touched the salt with the tip of my tongue, it probably wouldn't?
Well, it turns out, once again, these are maps that were drawn basically 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's not as if it's a changing threshold. And
it's not exclusive to one part of the tongue.
It's more likely when they put tiny little amounts on, you're much more likely to taste sweet in the front of the tongue, salt and sour on the sides of the tongue, and bitter in the back of the tongue. But there are a couple of other things that are important here. I've always been taught that these are the four tastes. Everything else is through the nose. And the answer is probably not. The Japanese coined a term, umami. And umami means fullness. It's sort of the taste of savory. So when you eat something and your mouth feels like it's really full and delicious, mm-hmm. and you bite into something and you go there, they believe that that's another taste. And they found that these are common in miso and in soy sauce, which when they're brewed, produce more monosodium glutamate. Mm-hmm. So they produce natural monosodium glutamate. And so the theory now within science is that maybe we've been very simplistic with this, and we never had a way of tasting savory because we can't divide it up into something that's easy to test on the tongue. Yeah. And I do believe in umami, in this savory taste, because you make certain things and you have this fullness in your mouth.
Aren't taste and smell kind of the same? I mean,
they're not the same. They're in different parts of the brain. They're not the same, but in our brain, we move them together.
Yeah,
because it tastes good and it smells good at the same time, and that's hard for me to differentiate. But people who have either they ruin their olfactory sensors in the brain can often only taste four things, and they may taste savory. So I've got a cousin, perfect example. About 20 years ago, she lives in a loft in Soho, New York.
Yeah.
And 20 years ago, they were fixing some things in the loft, and she fell through a trap door down to the floor below, hit the back of her head, and the only injury is she can't smell anything.
Oh.
So I said, how does that affect you? She said, well, it's very difficult. First of all, I can textures I like, but certain things taste sweet to me, like vodka. I said, vodka? She said, yes, I'll take vodka, and all I take, it tastes sweet. It tastes the same to me as orange juice. I said, vodka tastes the same as orange juice? She said, I have to be very careful when I go to parties. I go to artistic parties all the time, and I have to ask what's in something when I drink it, because it may be punch, and it may be spiked punch. And if it's spiked punch, I don't want to get drunk, because I can still get drunk, but I cannot taste the taste of alcohol.
I was going to ask you, she's at a loft in Soho. Is she an artist? Yeah, she's
she
an
is.
Artist.
She is, yeah.
Artist. Everybody's an artist. Who lives on
no,
a
no, no, but they bought it 30 years ago. They're the real artists. They're not the fake artists. They're the real artists. They're nuts. They're crazy. They don't have any money. They're always scrambling for things. They're the real artists. They're real McCoy.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, a listener joins in now in Norris, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Fine, how can we help you?
My question is, I was listening about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I heard you talking about the placebo effect, and I know that y'all talk about that probably quite a bit.
Yep.
It's something that I'm sure is on quite a few people's minds, but I was wondering, is there anything such as the reverse placebo effect, whereas say a doctor were to prescribe a medication for a patient that really would work. It was definitely proven to work, but for some reason that patient didn't believe that that medication could work for them. Would that have the fact that the patient did not believe that it would work, would that have an adverse, a negative effect on the ability of the medication to work?
Interesting. I'll bet you, Zorba, the answer is yes.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And what usually that manifests in terms of side effects. So I'll have people who will say, well, I don't want to take a statin drug, and they may need it, because I know I'm going to get a muscle ache, and then they get a muscle ache right away because there's the belief system that they'll get a muscle ache. Now, I don't take a statin drug, and my muscles ache right now. If I think about it, you know, I mean, they may ache because I am an older guy and I have aches. You know, I get up in the morning, I may have a little ache. Well, if I think it's the drug and I stop the drug, I may feel the ache goes away. And in fact, I'm just attending to the sensation. So, you bring up, though, a really, really good point that when you look from a medical care point of view, it's really we're both, to use our vernacular, have to be on the same page. You really want a physician who prescribes things or recommends things to you, and you want to believe in that physician, so you really believe that the prescriptions are going to be worthwhile, and then you're likely to get the best care because you're both going to be thinking in the same fashion. Fewer side effects, more likely that the drugs will have an effect on you. Now, you know, to some extent this – it doesn't play out at all. If you're looking at something like an antibiotic for strep throat, you may get side effects, but you don't really care. You may just stay on it until the antibiotics have completely run their course. But for other things, yes, the reverse placebo effect is also present. A question, do you exercise at all?
I actually work for an airline, and I'm throw bags, like I'm handle bags all day, that exercise.
Oh, well, that is exercise. So now I've got to ask another question. Do you like your job?
Do I like what I do, or do I like the people I work with?
Well, that's part of it. The people you work with are definitely part of your job. That's an important issue.
I like the things that I do, but I think with any job, you're going to find people that you don't enjoy working with, and that would certainly be the case.
So it's the same kind of a situation. Here it is. You've got a situation where there are issues that you like about it and issues that you don't like about it. And so in order to function and function well, you concentrate on those things that you like about it. It's the same thing with medical care. If you function on why you're taking something or doing something, you're much more likely to get an improvement in your condition versus if you look at the side effects or the bad issues of what you're doing. And that shows where the mind plays a role in how we function.
I wondered where you were going with that.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. You weren't sure where I was going at all.
No,
little faith.
Before we let you go, I have a quick question. You toss bags around. You don't sing or you aren't on the radio because your voice, you got nice pipes there. You ought to do something with them.
You know, I hear that all the time, and I just, I'm really not sure how to get started in it, so.
Well, head for your local public radio station and just say good morning, and my guess is you'll be there for a while.
Well, that's sounds like a plan. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's help out one of our listeners named Annika. She's concerned with her boyfriend's inability to burp. She writes, "This sounds trivial, but when he drinks carbonated beverages, he gets what we have dubbed the nerps. He seems to get a rising feeling in his chest that periodically interrupts his speech. He has to hold his breath and bend his chin down toward his chest as though he's going to burp, but all he can do is apologize for his nerping to whomever he's speaking. As his girlfriend, I would prefer that he burp rather than have to do his weird nerping activity. He does burp maybe once every 6 months, but when it happens, it seems to be completely involuntary and he doesn't know how to reproduce it. He's a beer lover, so I don't see him giving up the carbonation, if that's the solution. Do you have any other suggestions?"
You know, this is serious stuff.
It's not a wacky question.
So she wants him to burp, and he's not burping.
It goes.
So, you know, I mean, it's the opposite of the people who are passing too much gas and want to stop gassing the other issues. Well, you know, what happens is he's actually got a tight sphincter. Mm-hmm. The sphincter, his esophageal sphincter, is very, very tight, and as a result, he doesn't have to burp, and that gas, the carbonation, will come out. Either it gets absorbed and reprocessed in the body, or it comes out the other end in flatus, the appropriate term that we use, for gastric bypass.
I would guess that if it were actually...
Not necessarily. Yeah. I think we need more information on this case before I am ready to render a judgment. I think we have to know whether or not, if he does not burp, if his problem is he passes too much gas.
Yeah, well,
that's the real question.
In any case, she started it out saying this sounds trivial. And, you know, as relationship problems go, this one is, you know, way down the
Well, I don't know. I mean, she thought about enough so it was important for her to do it. So it may not be a trivial thing. She may be a burper. And she may be upset that he's not burping. We need more information.
I shouldn't
on
be
a case
judgmental,
like
should I? No.
I don't think you should be judgmental. When it comes to gas and it comes to burping, we in America have strong opinions.
If you or someone you know suffers from something that can't be defined, let us know by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, with help today from Mike Raffone. Charles Monroe Kane stands in as our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1220Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.